Watch out! It's a fury of T's! I certainly don't know what that means. But I'll tell you what I do know, guys. T-Fury is the original pop culture t-shirt destination, selling unique designs every day since 2008. You can snag their shirts for only 24 hours, starting at midnight. Hey, you! Missing a shirt from the past and want to get it again? Head to the T-Fury Gallery, where you can buy some old designs still in print and vote on others to come back from the dead. You know, I like to say zombie style. Every 2 to 4 weeks, T-Fury adds more designs to their gallery, so be sure to keep an eye out for the return of your favorite shirts. T-Fury shirts cover all your favorite topics and fandoms. They got everything from gaming, sci-fi, anime, TV, movies, pop culture, and more. Their t-shirts change daily, so check back as often as you'd like. Also, feel free to get a life if you're not able to check in that much. I don't think anybody's going to hate you for it. Also, don't forget about the T-Fury After Hours sale. If you miss the day's shirt by only a little, they keep the sale going into the wee hours of the morning just for you. Check out tfury.com/nerdist and see what today's shirt is all about. Guys, that is advertising. Hey guys, welcome to episode 94 of the JV Club with my marvelous guest, Catherine Burrell. I need to quickly acknowledge that I had a slight dip in microphone activity on my part, on my end, for some of the episode. My dog, Whitley, you'll hear a part where we're like, oh, she just pulled all on the cord, like all the cords out. And shortly thereafter, there were a couple of places where my microphone kind of dipped. In and out of being able to be heard very quickly. And it was inconsistent. So I want to just give a major, major thanks to Caitlin, who listened to the episode and just helped me kind of clean it up a little bit and fix those little issues. So thank you so much for that, Caitlin. Adore you. See you here in San Francisco at Sketchfest. Of course, I am recording this in San Francisco for Sketchfest. We open tomorrow. When this comes out, tomorrow will be today. That's how the future works. And we have our opening night with the 10th anniversary of Napoleon Dynamite with Cast and with Tenacious D, and a tribute that we're doing to them. So can't wait to get it kicked off. Obviously, things are crazed and I'm trying to stay caught up on everything, but I do have time for some shout outs. Gotta make time for those. Via email, I want to thank Roberto, Terry, Ashley S, and Chloe. It's a very international set of emails from all over, including Ireland, Moscow, Brazil. Just exciting, guys. Makes me feel very, very intercontinental. Is that the word I'm looking for? Gosh, I hope so. On Twitter, I want to thank Gator Girl, Lynn W, Alana, Maggie M, Beware of Trees, Ken L, Hannah, always looking out for me, suggesting I get more diverse. I really want to promise you that that is something that is constantly at the forefront of my brain, and I have so many asks out at any given time to women who are not Caucasian. Boy, you know, I don't know what to tell you other than, like, I just don't get a lot of yeses or replies from a lot of the women I've reached out to. But I'm pleased to say that Aisha and I are in touch and that we're definitely going to make it happen in the months to come. So you can look forward to that. I know I do. Via Facebook, I want to thank Kate, Alexander, and Alexis. And then on Amira's Nerdist page, so far we've had weigh-ins from Joseph, Mark, Scott, Andrew, and Minky. And I'll respond to those when I get a shot on the page itself. So thanks so much, guys. And yeah, if you hear a couple of moments in this episode where my voice kind of drops out in the background, we felt it wasn't that important to hear me going, because the priority is really the stories that Catherine is telling. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope to hear from you soon. Bye.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
All right, this train's moving. This train has left the station.
Yeah, your dog just left the station.
Dog left the station. Oh boy. Yeah, she's certainly interested in engaging, like, right now in this moment when we're just getting started.
She understands that it's
sitting next
her
to me.
Her 15 minutes, the clock's up on her 15 minutes.
Yeah. It's become very like she just got into the passenger seat of this car that I'm driving on the wrong side of the road because we're in Britain.
Yeah.
Catherine, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Here it is, everybody.
I don't even know why you wanted to have me on exactly. What? Yeah, this is your opportunity to flatter me.
Oh, good. Oh, that's what this is. Okay, good. So now I'm pitching you on why.
Yeah, while why
you're,
am I
while
here?
You're doing the podcast, I'm in the midst of pitching you on it. Listen, you're very funny.
Thanks.
You're in this world of ours that we live in.
Right.
That's my criteria.
That's fine. That's good enough for me.
We got along like a house on fire the first time we hung out at a Kenny Loggins concert.
At a Kenny Loggins concert, which like Kenny Loggins, and I think I told you this during the show, like he's like my nightmare artist.
Yes. One of the reasons I respect you so much.
Thank you. I don't know if you remember his stage pattern. I don't know if any of your listeners are fans of Kenny Loggins, so apologies if that's the case, but
it's almost exclusively Kenny Loggins.
It's the Kenny Loggins, the JB and KL podcast. He was, all of his stage pattern involved like how he managed to corporatize his music. He was like, I became popular because I was dating the daughter of the CEO of Disney or whatever.
Oh my God, that's right.
So he was kind of canny, but I found that he was so dumb in his canniness that I don't know. It's like I'd try trust him. Like I'd trust him if I was dating him, but I'd be embarrassed to be dating him, you know?
So you would constantly be kind of defending him to other people, but really you're just defending him to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's armchair psychology to the hilt. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, that makes me wonder, like, how many times do we defend someone legitimately to someone else and aren't really defending them to ourselves? Like, that seems rare to me.
Yeah, I feel like most of the time that you're bothering to say something out loud, you're usually trying to convince your audience and yourself, I think.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, it's the way that you can never, whenever you're giving somebody advice, it's usually advice that you need to be giving yourself.
Oh, that's certainly
true. But then you can never take it.
Well, that's so bad for this podcast. But I constantly do say, like, any advice I give, it's pretty much because, like, it's stuff I need to keep relearning over and over again.
Yeah, life is a perishable skill.
I mean, it really is.
Every day I wake up and I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to manage today.
Yeah.
And then I go to sleep. I'm like, I managed not to kill myself. So that's great.
I did it.
So it's a win.
I did it. Yeah. Well, that's a great, listen, this has been a great podcast.
So far, great. I'll leave now.
You've dispensed some very valuable information.
And right off the top.
Assured us that you make it every day without committing suicide.
Yeah.
So that's a
You
plus.
Never know what's going to happen at the end of today,
oh,
but.
That's a plus.
We're eating pizza together, though, at the end of the day today. So that's a goal.
Listen, knock on wood.
Stay alive until pizza. Stay alive until the pizza party. Stay alive until the, and I feel like heaven is a pizza party. If there is a heaven, I don't believe in heaven, but if there was, it would be a pizza party.
I'm sure you're right.
Borrowed some stones from hell to make the best Napolese pizza oven in the sky.
I mean, it's a give and take. I mean, listen, there's still like a good, still a good relationship and agreement happening between Lucifer.
Yeah.
And God, our
there's
father.
like an economic bilateral agreement that they
That's
have.
Right.
They don't have a theological or philosophical agreement, but there's got to be
Listen,
trading
we're a,
happening.
We're a capitalist economy. It's just realistic. It's a supply and demand situation.
If God made us in his image, then God is a capitalist. And I mean,
and he made pizza. Guys, I apologize.
God
all of you
pizza?
Who are full on practicing Christians who believe in heaven and hell, we don't know what's out there. I mean, Catherine and I don't know.
No. Well, we know that we are all made of stardust, but so is pizza.
God.
Pizza's made of stardust,
Everything's
too.
Everything's made of stardust.
Including pizza and hamburgers.
Why does that stardust taste so good?
I don't know.
Oh,
cheese.
Man.
I thought you didn't eat cheese and bread.
Well, he's doing a gluten-free pizza crust for me so that I don't have explosive diarrhea and
That's
vomiting.
That's really nice.
So everyone
your
wins
Your boyfriend's
in that
trying to prevent you from having explosive diarrhea.
I don't think he would like that any more than I would.
He's so oppressive. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
You should just...
As a woman, I have the right to have explosive diarrhea.
He's got two toilets in that house.
I know. What is he thinking?
I've taken dumps in both of your boyfriend's
have you?
Toilets.
Have
yeah.
you?
Definitely.
Do you have a preference on which bathroom was better?
Yeah, Martin has a, I don't know if he still has it, but he has a brown bath mat in his master bathroom.
Okay.
And I find that, like, you've got to be really careful. Here's some great advice, listeners. You've got to be really
so
careful about the color of bath mat that you get, because too light, everything shows up,
right.
All the stains. But too dark, all of the dust and the little
lint,
threads
all the
and
lint and all that
shows up. So like a slate gray, I think, is the best for a... bath mat. So yeah. Martin had a dark brown bath mat in his master bath. And so I always felt like, even if it was just cleaned, I felt like it was always a little dirty. And there's always something a little creepy about like your bare feet on someone else's bath mat.
Okay.
Where the lint is of unknown provenance.
Oh, okay. So here's where I was surprised is that I felt that you were saying you were in support of the brown bath mat.
No. I think it's too dark.
You prefer the guest bathroom. Yeah. But isn't that like a, was there like a white rug in there? That's,
I don't know. I think there was at one point, I think it might have been removed, but it was around the sink. I think it wasn't around the toilet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand.
I don't know.
How often do you feel yourself thinking through this stuff when you're like at someone's house?
Here's a fun fact about me is that I grew up in hotels. My father was a hotel manager, so I lived in a lot of hotels growing up. So it's like I feel like I had a pretty intimate understanding of like how dirty things get when they're just used on a daily basis. Yeah. And you know, like we're not like cleaning our sheets every day. We're not like. I would always think about the traffic on rugs in hotels, like new shoes coming in from all over the world, like pressing themselves on these rugs. And, you know, the idea, it's like the sort of the Howard Hughes, like the close up of all of the microbes that are probably conglomerating in the fibers of the rugs. So I feel like because I've ruminated on that a lot because I've been in these, my private space was public spaces a lot when I was growing up.
You wrote about this. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I wrote this book about my dad and because my dad was the hotel manager. There's like little stories about sort of him being, in the hotels and me being in the hotels because of the fact that our family was together.
Yeah.
The way that our family worked was that we all lived together. and I don't know how your family worked anyway.
How are babies made? Yeah. Sort of from the ground up.
There's a fishbowl.
Okay.
There's a fishbowl and the moms and the dads put goo in the fishbowl. Yeah. And then
the stork, where does the stork come in?
I think the stork comes and like poops in the fishbowl. Yes. You form a seal over it.
Great.
It all kind of like there's like a fungus. Sort of. Yeah, there's like a fungus that forms and you break it and then a baby comes out. And, like,
great.
It gets opaque.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like a clay pot and then you can't see through it.
You're not saying anything we don't already know.
You take a little hammer, like one of those little archaeological hammers, and then you just tippy tap it until it all shatters and then there should be a newborn baby boy or girl.
Oh my God. In that'd there. Be so weird.
And that's how babies are made.
That's
everybody.
Great. God, we've learned so much already.
Yeah, a few things.
Well, so the sort of ambling around. God, like where does that start and how many different cities were you in, or was it mostly just like the same city?
No, it was a medium amount. So I was born in Toronto and I was brought home like from the hospital to a hotel and then we moved to Bermuda for a year. We lived in a hotel there. And then we moved to New Jersey. I would say New York, but I'm just going to be honest with you. It was New Jersey. And we moved into a house and I was 5. And I remember like driving up. I feel like I've told this story before to somebody, possibly you. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Maybe you have some listeners who haven't met me, who haven't heard the story. But we drove up to this house. And I remember asking my mother, I was like, oh, this seems like a really small place. Like how many other people are going to be living in here with us? And she was like, oh, no, this is a home. Like this is a single family home, and this is how a single family home works.
Oh, wow.
Which was foreign to me.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. And then the following morning, the story goes is that they found me in the kitchen, and I had pushed a chair up to the wall where there was a landline, and I had the phone in my hands, and I was dialing 2, and my mom was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Room service isn't answering."
Oh, that's a priceless.
So it was a paradigm shift. So then, I figured out, you know, after like a little while, I figured out what a home was, and then we moved to Dallas 4 years after. We lived in a hotel again. Called the Lowe's Anatole, which is now owned by Hilton. It's a very large hotel that has like peacock like grounds and peacocks running free on the grounds and koi ponds. And my little brother almost drowned in a koi pond when he was 3. And there was like tennis. It was all very fancy, but we were like, it felt fancy because of the context, but you know, it was just like we had a normal apartment in the hotel. We just had like access to more stuff, you know.
Let me go ahead and ask these two requisite questions that you probably get asked all the time. 2 movies. How do you feel about The Shining and how do you feel about My Bodyguard?
Okay. The Shining, we never lived in a space that was so isolated as The Shining. So I feel like when I saw it, I didn't have any like points of like visceral recognition.
Yeah, no connection to that anybody else normally. Who
and my father's like, he's pretty, he's like a Parisian, like a Parisian clown. So he's like as far away from Jack Nicholson as you could possibly get.
If Jack Nicholson listens to this podcast, which I'm sure he does,
he's
probably very upset that you feel that he doesn't have it within him to play a Parisian clown.
A buffon. Before he dies, let's get him into a buffon.
Please,
play
by
the
all
white
means.
Clown, Jack.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
You got to tell me what My Bodyguard is. I don't know what that is.
Oh, I love My Bodyguard so much.
It's not The Bodyguard.
It's definitely not The Bodyguard.
Okay.
I'm trying to think if there's anything similar other than that someone plays a bodyguard in each. My Bodyguard is one of my favorite movies from the 1980s. It might even be like 79 or something.
Okay.
Or early 70s, but earlier in the 70s. But it's Adam Baldwin, who was on Firefly. We were talking about Jewel a second ago. It was one of his first big roles, and it is a story about this young kid, I think played by Chris Makepeace, who lives in a hotel. His father's played by Martin Mull. Grandmother's played by Ruth Gordon. So it's like a really great, warm cast of like 70s actors. And he is bullied at school, and he ends up paying.
Why is he bullied? Because he's a nerd.
Yeah, he's just like a scrawny little nerd.
He's a pencil neck geek.
And so he finds out about this guy named Ricky Linderman, who's almost never in school. And there's this horrible rumor that he shot his brother.
Uh-huh.
And so he's this like very feared character and everyone's afraid of him. And then Matt Dillon plays this like really good, just like asshole bully who is the person responsible for kind of leading the ring of bullies that bully Chris Makepeace. And Chris Makepeace comes up with this idea to pay Ricky Linderman to be Adam Baldwin, to be his bodyguard.
Right.
And so it's just great. It's such a great movie.
It sounds great.
Because the relationship between the two of them, of course, blossoms into this friendship. And you sort of learn about both of them and why they're both lone wolves and isolated. And it's such a great movie.
I'll watch it.
So he lives in a hotel in New York. His dad's like a hotel manager.
Because I feel like you were going to ask me, like, do you own the book Eloise, which I think was given to me by everyone in the world
I've ever read it.
Oh, it's great. She's, you know, she's a little girl who lives. She lives in not the Waldorf Astoria. She lives in the Plaza in New York. She has a turtle that she.
Familiar.
Yeah, she's just a little cartoon lady, and she's a girl, and she's got a nanny, and who's really big and proper, and she has a little turtle that has a bow around the shell. And she leads him around on a leash, and that's pretty, you know, she just runs around the hotel. And
from when you were really little, you said you got it?
Yeah, we got, because, well, the two books that I always got was Eloise, because everyone was like, oh, you're just like the kid who lives in a hotel. You're like that one book where there's a girl who lives in a hotel, so here. And then because we moved around a lot, I got Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss the time, so I have like 70 copies of that book as well.
Yeah.
Which, like, I understand is a book that...
Your
dog just ran away with the computer cord. There we go.
Is a
book that typically people get when they graduate from college.
Yes, I certainly got at least two copies when I graduated from college. You got it. You started early.
I know. I was like the Doogie Howser of Dr. Seuss inheritances.
Yes, you were.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that makes me special.
I don't know. It's a pretty big deal. It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had gone to the places that that yellow suited boy went in or the places you'll go. I feel like life hasn't been as fantastical as that.
But it still is. Yeah. So it's interesting because it sort of has that. You have one of those histories or those sort of stories that feels like it could crack open, like when, like if someone hears part of it, that their expectation would then be like, wow, regale me with all of the crazy worldwide adventures you had living in a hotel.
Yeah.
And then you feel the obligation to be like, well, listen, it wasn't that crazy.
I think that when you're a kid, you're just like, it's your reality. So you're not like, you're not mythologizing your reality. I think that's up to adults. Like we mythologize our childhoods.
Well said.
So at the time you're not really doing it. So everything, and I think that like kids just want to feel normal all the time. So they're just like, this is normal. I'm like stealing a sandwich from a ballroom in Dallas, which is also my house. Like, this is normal. I met like George H.W. Bush, you know, in like 1990 or something, or 1989. Yeah. And, you know, but it felt normal because like it was in my house sort of thing. So I just name dropped the worst man. I'm like, let me tell you when I was
nine. Get it. You met really cool, yeah, famous people.
We're great friends to this day. But yeah, no, I mean, it didn't feel strange. And then sort of when you're obviously retelling it, when you're an adult, it all sounds a little strange. Like I had a tennis instructor named Randy Beaver, and it was like, that didn't even occur to me as funny until I was like 25 and telling the story at a party. I was like, oh yeah, no, I was a pretty good tennis player. This tennis instructor named Randy. And they're like, oh, haha, Randy. And I was like, oh yeah. And his last name was Beaver. And he also was a pervert who hit on my mother. Like, I mean, I remember him being like very sort of like sexually out there. And yeah, you know, it's like his name did predestine him to the fate of a Randy Beaver.
I guess so. What choice did he have? Zero.
I think about him a lot, actually. I feel like I should look him up.
How old were you when Randy Beaver was in your life?
I was like, I was 9 or 10.
Which hotel was this?
This was in Dallas. This was the Dallas one. I think he was probably in his early 30s. So he's 20 years. So yeah, he's got to be in his 50s, like his you know, early 50s now.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's still scoring mad poon. Because he'd like date, you know, he'd date women at the hotel. Like he was always some new hot lady who was staying at the hotel.
Oh, that's so amazing. That those cliches that you feel like only exist in films, and then there's a reason that.
Yeah,
that
like tennis pros, golf pros, exists. Like that's the point. Like you get into it. If you're not actually a professional tennis player and you're a tennis pro at a club, like you probably don't have benefits, you know, dental and otherwise, your benefits
you get
are
your
just
sexual
like
benefits.
Unlimited. Pussy.
Unhappy women.
Just yeah, that's right.
Oh, no.
Women who like are there, you know, and it was like the late 80s where, you know, like men were coming in on conferences and, you know, I'm sure their wives were, it's like Dirty Dancing. He was like Patrick Swayze in Dirty Dancing,
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Women.
God, I wonder if he saw that movie and was like, he fancied,
I'm gonna model myself
that
after that. Yeah.
I can really relate to that guy.
And I mean, it's
that
perfect.
That movie was made for me.
And the outfits are even better than the dance, because it's like tiny white tennis skirts bloomers showing all the time.
You
like
bet.
A flash of ass all the time.
You bet.
It's basically like, it's the most nude kind of sport besides swimming, really.
It's the most nude kind of
sport.
It's
the most provocative outfit. Like, I can't think of a more provocative sports outfit, actually, than women's tennis.
Yeah, because it's also kind of attached to this weird, like, what other place do you see this sort of like pleated skirt other than like the young girl, parochial girl,
cheerleaders, like all of the common sex fantasies are enacted in the sport of women's tennis.
It's so true.
To this day, actually, they should put some pants on, man.
I know.
I mean, whatever. They should wear whatever's comfortable. It is nice to feel like I wear tennis skirts when I play.
I do enjoy a tennis dress.
It's very, like the cool breeze on your crotch while you're running around.
I wear underwear. I don't know if you do.
No. I'm not into cooter shots unless I'm on the court.
We may have figured out part of the problem.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why people think it's so provocative. Men do it when they wear kilts in Scotland. Wait, are we supposed to wear?
No, I refuse to wear. I always wore shorts when I played when I was a kid, but I got into skirts when I was an adult. But no, I mean, I wear like several. I like wear like three pairs of underwear when I play tennis. I'm so afraid of like falling out of my skirt. Like two or three pairs. Like there's like my underwear, then I wear a pair of sport shorts, and then there's like the built-in shorts of the skirt. Like,
oh yeah, you're very.
I'm like
thorough.
Triple bagging it.
It's pretty great. It's pretty, plus, listen, I don't know what you got going on down there, but maybe it's like a jockstrap or like things
vaginas.
Are moving around.
There's
a lot of stuff moving around down there.
I have three vaginas. It's so, I might as well use your podcast as an opportunity to tell everybody I've got three of them.
I didn't know I was going to crack this wide open, so to speak. These
three
wide
times.
Open.
We cracked it open three times today.
I call them the Trinity.
Yeah.
Amazing. Wow.
One for the Father, one for the
this
Son, and one for the Holy
else.
Spirit.
Oh my God. Which one's your favorite?
Holy Spirit.
Oh, of course.
He gets to be whatever he wants, you know.
Of course.
What do you want my name to be today, Holy Spirit?
This has gone wrong.
I feel bad because I actually, you know, we moved and we've got this church across the street from us with this like cool priest. He's always wearing like a polar fleece, like zip up. And yep, I was thinking,
nothing cooler than Polar
Freeze. Cool, he waves to everybody, and he seems like the community really likes him. He just seems like a rad guy, and he's just like really friendly. And
it's a Catholic church.
I think it's a Catholic church. Yeah. And I mean, I wasn't raised with religion. But I've been passing by a lot just because he's right across the street, and he seems to be very involved. He seems to be progressive, and I was like, can I go in there to get free psychological advice? Like, is confession just a free way of getting, like, to not pay $200 for 45 minutes of a shrink job? Like, can I just go in there? And it seems like a great resource. Like,
yeah,
you know, everyone's using the same sort of like loose ethical tenets,
right,
whether they're atheist or not.
I just wonder, because I'm not Catholic, and for those of you who are Catholic, I invite you to share some of your stories with me if you'd like, but how much counseling is different from confession. Like, if confession is just very simple process, like a quick phone boothy kind of situation where you like unload some stuff quickly and then get in, get out, versus like getting a counseling session from your advisor, your spiritual advisor at church. Because I do envy people, to your point, that are like, you know, I have a friend who's very involved in his church, and like he for sure goes to his pastor first. Like, he trusts him implicitly and will go to him with problems about his relationship or with his, you know, his work or stress level or whatever. And that person is an amazing free resource.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, it is great.
But you just need to be part of it. I think you need to join that. You need to join that club.
Yeah, I don't know if Polar Fleece is going to like unlock the secrets of spiritual happiness.
I can't just come in for like a
rap
supper
session
or whatever, like on Sunday.
Just a quick, just friendly rap session with a priest.
The church dropped off little gift baskets before Christmas with like tasteful crackers and cheese and onion dip inside.
Oh, wow. That's really nice.
Yeah. That's like that's proselytizing that I can get behind. Like, not somebody there at the door, you know, preaching the word of God, just like a tasteful cheese basket that's dropped off.
Very, very nice.
I think they're smart. I think they're, I don't know. There's something going on with that church that I'm into.
Yeah, I like the sound of everything that you're saying. Well, when we were in France over Christmas, we went into Notre Dame because they were having this, you know, they have like this extraordinary, it's that
mass
moment where,
Christmas
it's
mass.
That moment where I felt like, and I certainly wasn't doing it for the spectacle of it. Like, this is cool. Let's see how crazy people act on Christmas. Like, it's not that. I feel tremendous respect and like,
I don't even know one person be like, how fucking crazy are these motherfuckers going to get on Christmas?
No, but you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there are people who are like, I have very staunchly atheistic friends who would potentially go into a church just to be like, not so overt, but that there's a sense of like, boy, I really can't believe this is a thing. Can you believe this is a thing?
Right.
This is a thing.
Hoodwinking while being there.
A little bit. Definitely just the sort of otherness of something like, oh, this is what other people do.
Yeah.
I think that what's good about like, that Mark and I have the same sort of, I don't talk about my relationships that much on the podcast. It's funny because you're his friend, so it's coming up. But like, he's never been named on the podcast until this point.
His name's Martin. He's great.
He is great.
I love him.
But
Janet, I love him.
Oh. Listen, I don't know what to say about this plus your three vagina situation.
We'll discuss it over pizza. Okay. Pizza heaven tonight.
Tonight, God willing. God willing, we make it to pizza. But I think we both have this sort of same agnostic and like the kind of enjoyment of the magical wonder of religion. And so when we went in to the church that night, I sort of felt like not only was I doing it for my Catholic friends to whom that would have been a Mecca situation. Like, I can't believe you're getting to be at Notre Dame on Christmas Eve. That's so amazing.
Yeah.
And also just for the beauty of it and the architecture. And like, I don't have a problem singing Christmas songs that are about Jesus without it meaning anything to me, in the same way that I like singing about Santa Claus. I just feel like it's lovely.
It means something very important to a lot of people. And that's
fine. In this context, I'm not going to make it about like the ways in which he's been used for ill and violence.
Of course.
Like, let's just make it this beautiful spiritual experience or, you know, nostalgic experience or what have you. And so it was nice to just be there and sort of breathe in and honestly to kind of try on that piece of the night with all these people to whom it's extremely important, and to feel reverent about it. But also, I guess the long story short, long story long, is that the priest, in this situation where you, I guess we were both very surprised because we expected a very traditional situation because that seems so ancient and mm-hmm. like, you know, this church is so old and the Catholic Church is so, can be so rigid. And this priest that was leading that particular mass was like, in French, saying, you know, I just want to welcome everyone. I want to welcome all the visitors who were standing in the back who came in because they're tourists, and welcome you into our mass together. And, you know, we really believe in diversity, and we really believe in like the rights of people to do and live their lives as they want, and we don't judge, and da da. And it was so liberal.
Yeah.
And so it was such an amazing dichotomy to be in like the most traditional Catholic experience I feel like you could have, short of like being in Rome or something,
sure,
on Christmas Eve, and still have this like, and thousands of people are there, and to still have this priest, you know, saying like, listen, different strokes for different folks,
it's all good,
Merry
guys.
Christmas.
It's neat, yeah, to experience religion as with cultural curiosity, or like with the cultural openness that one would go to any city or any country if you don't have a, you know, huge understanding of it. It's actually a really nice way, I think, to approach. It's a much more empathetic way, I think, to approach religion. Is like, oh, this is a culture that I'm not a part of, but that I'm interested in.
Yeah,
because there are good and bad parts of every culture.
Absolutely.
In the same way that they're good and bad parts of every religion. So.
Absolutely. That's a really, really good way of putting it. Was there anything like religion at all in your home front?
No. We have in my family, you mean?
Yeah.
We're like long generations upon generations of agnostics and atheists. But my dad, before getting into hotels, was a chef and, you know, Parisian, so classically trained.
Yeah, when
French
was he
chef.
A Parisian clown?
He was a Parisian clown chef in, I guess it would have been, his father got sick with emphysema when he was 13, so that would be in the early 50s, and basically my grandfather had to quit his job, so the family was going to be out on the street unless my dad got a job. So he got a job as a dish pig in a restaurant and just scrubbed dishes, and then worked his way up the ranks and ended up working at the Jean Jacinque in Paris and as a night chef, and he sort of worked all over the place. I ended up like going to I think England for a while. Anyway, food was our thing. I mean, this is so stupid. It's like, food was our thing. It's like, yeah, obviously everyone has to eat dinner together when you're family.
But that's super different.
But it was like, neat. Yeah. It was like, it was really, and he got, you know, by the time, so he was in hotels by the time I was around. He wasn't a chef anymore, but meals were always a big thing. Like sitting, we were never the type of family who didn't, I mean, this is, most people try to obviously have the goal to like sit down all family like for a dinner, but we did pretty much every night, and my dad usually opened a bottle of wine and he'd let me and my little brother taste it, and it was just this opportunity to sort of commune in the way that one would commune at mass on Sunday or whatever.
Sure.
So that was the closest thing we had. It was like over a tin of foie gras. I'm saying myself, that was such a douche.
Great,
no, it's great.
Did he impart a love of cooking onto you?
Yeah. Well, he it was more like fear based. He made me a sous chef for like really early on. So it's like, if I wasn't washing the parsley properly, or if like my knife skills weren't good at a certain age, you know, he'd sort of like publicly humiliate me, and his whole thing was like, I know you can do better than this. Like, why are you fucking around? Like, you can do better than this. He was like that with everything with me. In fact, I went to therapy to talk about this when I was in my mid 20s, but like I would come back with art projects, and some of them he'd be like, this is incredible. And like with half of them, he'd be like, I don't know, I feel like you didn't put your all into it, and I know you can work harder than this. And so I feel like with most of the things that I expressed even like a passing interest in, he would definitely kind of like kindly and hilariously bully me into being better at them. And so I think that I was like, it wasn't so much a love of cooking as it was a fear of disappointing my father.
Interesting.
So I became like, I think I'm competent enough in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it has gone from fear to love. Like I cook from hopefully a place of love now, but it definitely started from a place of fear.
No kidding. And what did your mom do?
My mom was a homemaker, you know, like raised me and my brother. I've got an older half brother named Mark as well. So he was a tempestuous teen during those years when I was a kid. And she was also a really great cook. She's British. I think she cooked for like the Archbishop of Canterbury when she was a young. So we came from like a cooking family. So I guess, yeah. So when I'm talking about food, like food qua religion or whatever, I guess it makes sense because they both have pretty heavy cooking backgrounds.
How did they meet?
They met, my mom was my dad's secretary.
Fantastic.
And he was married and they fell in love. And it really, really was. And she knew that she couldn't be with him because he was married. And as she was sort of falling in love with him, she... it was like one night and they were both working late and she went into my father's office and she said, I can't work for you anymore. I have to quit. And he was like, well, why do you have to quit it? Can you tell me the reason why? And she's like, I don't want to talk about it. And he was like, well, is it something to do with the organization or is it personal? And she said, it's personal. And he said, well, can I ask what it is specifically? And she said, well, I'm in love with you. But then she grabbed her coat and then like stormed out of the office and they didn't see each other for a year. And then it was like the Easter long weekend in the mid-70s and like 1975 or something. And my mother, the story goes, is that my mother is like sitting in her apartment having a drink with her friend Neil. And she hears like something slide under the door to her apartment. So she gets up. She had this feeling about it. So she got up and ran to the door. And it was, I've never gotten to read it, but it was an amazing love letter from my father. And he was like, I'm leaving my wife. I'm going to London on business. When I come back on, you know, Easter Monday or whatever it was, you know, I want to come to your apartment. And, you know, if you say no, we'll never see each other again. But if you say yes, like we'll be together forever. And there's, and then she opened the door and he had disappeared like a ghost from the hallway. And yeah, and they've been together ever since.
And so was this a story that you would tell like your friends and other people? And did you believe all of it?
My dad was such a storyteller when I was growing up, and it was like I got wise to the fact. I mean, we all did. I think anyone does when you're sort of around like a real orator. You're like, wait a second, it's not everything that you're saying isn't true all the time. Like you're enjoying this too much. So obviously you're leaving out certain parts that are the difficult parts to kind of make this neater, or you're reordering things, or you're amplifying moments that maybe weren't as big or whatever. So I think that like when by the time I had heard the story and it had kind of like settled in, I was like, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the mechanics of it are true. They got together. There's, you know, it was very romantic. It was very difficult because my father left his family. You know, he had a wife and two young sons. So like that was the very difficult part of the story. But I think that it was, there's obviously so much that I don't know about it. And you know, my dad was a difficult guy at the beginning of their marriage. And I remember them having fights and my mother like packing suitcases and being like, I'm leaving. And my father saying stuff like, but I love you enough for two. And it all being very, you know, very sort of rock and roll. I never felt unsafe in the house, but it was certainly like there was lots of yelling going on behind closed doors, you know, that I remember. So that obviously factored into the fairy tale story.
How much of that do you think is cultural?
I think it has to do with being French. I think it has to do with being a male, like a man of a certain time, you know, when maybe it wasn't really called upon for men to talk about their feelings in a comprehensive way. And my mother is a real dialogue based person. So the worst thing you can do to my mom is not talk to her. And my father's big thing is not talking when he gets, you know, he doesn't do it so much anymore, but when he used to get very mad, he would just kind of close down. So for somebody who craves dialogue, the dialogue based solution, and somebody who just needs to sort of retreat for a couple of hours or a couple of days or a week or whatever, that was very difficult. So I feel like, yeah, I mean, the tempestuousness is, yeah, maybe there's some kind of like French passion, but I think it's more like it was specific to my dad being a man born in, you know, 1939. He also, you know, he was born and then raised at the tail end of World War II in France. And my grandfather was involved in the resistance efforts. So they were like, they were moving around a lot during his early childhood, and like, you know, apartments that he lived in were getting bombed. And so he has a lot of like difficult memories from his early childhood as well. And then they arrived as immigrants in Canada when he was really young and all this kind of stuff. So I feel like, you know, my dad has his reasons for shutting down as a protective device, you know? So I think, yeah, it's always like fun to be like, yes, he's totally like the, you know, the French clown and the passionate French guy, but it's also like just very specific to like where he, you know, where he came from and how he was raised and the stuff that he saw and that sort of thing.
It's interesting too, when you hear about relationships like that, where, you know, I'm just not that way. I think I feel like, why do that to yourself? You know, why find somebody that you have to work so hard on something with when you could just find someone where all that work is sort of already done and you can just kind of be together, and it isn't that much of a challenge.
Yeah, I think I think about that all the time, because it's like, and you know, when you get into your 30s, you know, like you hope that at one point during your 20s, you've had some like cataclysmically terrible thing that's happened to you to be like, hey, life's not a fucking cakewalk, dummy. Like something, some bad shit's going to go down. And hopefully it's like one or two things in your 20s, because it's only going to get worse as we get older and we get sicker and our bodies decay and our parents die and the random anarchy of things that can happen to us. So it's like, you don't really need the conflict in your relationship, because like the anarchy of life is going to do that for you. So I don't really understand. I mean, I completely understand why people get into relationships with those who they want to fight with, because maybe that's a way of shutting out all the stuff that potentially and will happen to you. But it's like, I've always felt like a partnership should be like just like two people standing holding hands on like a helipad, like as the wind blows around them, you know, and potentially knocks them into the sea. And it's like easier to stand up when you've got four legs on the ground and you're holding hands, you know, just like bracing yourself. So, oh, which is why I believe in polyamory, because then if you have 16 people and you've got 32 sets of legs, we're a huge team that fucks. Oh my God.
Well, I feel like I have to ask, because I wouldn't say that everyone feels that way. If there's something specific that has happened to you that made you feel more like, I mean, just to take us back, not to get too intense or deep, and you can tell me to fuck off if you want, but to get back even to what we were talking about sort of jokingly at the beginning of the podcast about this idea of just, you know, getting through the day and that kind of stuff. I mean, are there things that have happened to you? Because I think for a lot of us, somehow we end up narrowly missing those cataclysmic situations. I feel like, you know, my problems at that age were chemical. So it wasn't like something happened to me as much as something for, you know, like for many people flipped when I turned 18. It was like, oh, my brain is super complicated. I mean, I can speak honestly about myself and say that it wasn't until my 30s that things did start happening to me and around me that kind of made me go, oh, whoa. Shit, I didn't grow up enough. Like, you can't prepare your grown-upness for that kind of stuff. If it doesn't happen to you, it doesn't happen to
you.
And then you're left with, for me, this feeling of like, I feel like I should be more grown up by now. I don't know how to handle this thing that's happened because it's new and I'm too old for it to be so new.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that like, and yeah, I'll refer to like one incident like that I don't mind talking about, because I wrote about it in my book and I've sort of speak about it publicly. But just to your point quickly, I also think that when the really bad things happen, they're so strange and they're so unexpected that I think that you can't even really brace yourself for them. Like you can make sure that you've got a great resource of like friends, and hopefully you've got some family members who you trust, and maybe you've got a partner who is really helpful. But you're in a good place in your life and all that kind of stuff. It, like, that's the best you can do, is just like set up your network, you know? But because when the stuff, when what happened to me, and I always feel like a little bit bad, like trotting it out as a story, but in 2001 I got involved in a car accident that basically there was an old man jaywalking across a main thoroughfare that I was driving down, and I hit him, and he died 3 days later in the hospital. You know, I tried to swerve to not miss him, but it was just he appeared out of nowhere basically, and I hit him and I killed him. It could happen to anyone. Definitely. And it's like, you know, all you do then for the months thereafter is you're like, oh, if I had just like spent a little bit more time in the grocery store picking out this brand of ginger ale that I wanted to buy, but then it would have happened to somebody else and not me. It would have happened to somebody that day, you know, but it did happen to me. And that for me was, you know, the great reordering in terms of the way that I saw the world, because suddenly, you know, when you're 21, you're like full of hope. You're usually like, you know, if you've taken an orthodox path, you're graduating from college and the world is about to become your oyster and all that kind of good stuff. And so, and I was, you know, I was literally months away from graduating from college with like a journalism degree, and I was excited to go out into the world and like talk to people and be a journalist and stuff. I was a happy person, and I became a depressed person in the months thereafter and in the years thereafter, because it's a difficult thing. It's such a, I knew on a level that it wasn't my fault, but I had removed a life from the earth. So that was, you know, that was obviously like a very strange thing to reconcile. So yeah, I mean, I think that was like my big, that was my big trauma in my 20s. And, you know, like my friends would joke and still joke. They're like, well, you know, at least that thing happened. Like lightning can't strike twice. Right. And it's like, that's not true. You know, like lightning's going to strike a bunch more times probably. And, you know, I've had a few more things happen that I don't necessarily feel like I want to do. Like, I will tell you offline that are brutal. And, what is nice though about it's not, nothing is nice about the accident, but it did prepare me for the couple of other things that happened, insofar as I knew that depression, when you're in it, and you have talked, you know, you've talked about sort of having chemical stuff, like depression when you're in it feels like it's going to last forever. Like, this is it. This is my new reality. I'm only going to be here forever.
Yeah. And I also felt like I needed people to remind me that I hadn't always felt that way, you know, that there's a terminal, like it somehow moves backwards too. So you look at all of your life as if it's always been miserable.
It's like the most panoptic lens. It's like you look around 360, everything that's ever happened to you through space and time is in this like gray, awful lens.
Yeah.
And you need people and when something, because it was so stark for me, I was happy, then I was sad. And then I became okay again because I got out of it without killing myself, you know, because like that was definitely on the menu for a while. So what was nice about that experience, if you can call it nice, is I knew that there would be a time where it wouldn't feel like that anymore.
Huge. That understanding of, okay, this is a thing that is survivable, you know, that's a gift. And I agree with you. It's never fun to describe anything that befalls another person that you have anything to do with as tragic as that is, as a gift. But definitely there's some stuff where there's a sort of recognition of, you know, the two gifts that you get out of it. One of them's a bad gift. But for me, I feel like it's the unfortunate gift of dread, because you're not looking forward to surviving something bad again, mixed with the knowledge that you can survive something bad again. So it's sort of a double whammy.
It's the Matrix. It's the blue pill and red pill. And you're like, do you want this consciousness or not? And I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. And the good thing that comes out of it is at least you get to connect with other people who have that terrible knowledge. And, you know, and maybe I'm lying to myself. I'm like, I have a much deeper connection with people because I'm so sad, you know. But it's like, I and maybe that's just something, it's probably just something I tell myself in order to, you know, add a layer of like profundity to the experience. But, and that's fine. If I have to tell myself that, that's completely fine.
Right. But you already had an innate or developed interest in your fellow humans from what you're saying, you know, when you had this horrible thing happen. I can't imagine that it wouldn't just deepen your empathy. So it's not like you're this person who's completely antisocial, who has no interest in others, and then suddenly this opens that up for you.
In a way, it does become an accidental tool to sort of,
and it's fun to hone that tool too, you know, because it's like, I think that when it first happened to me in the years shortly after, you know, I was 22, 23, 24, I felt like I almost wanted to tell everybody about it, because I was like, hey, this is like, here's my wound. My wound is here. I act from my wound. So here, understand my actions, because this is what happened to me. And then you kind of sharpen it and you're like, okay, I don't have to tell everybody. It's not my whole self. I don't have to let this one thing define, you know, the entirety of me. And then you become a little bit more discreet about it. And then, because I think that like sometimes when something really terrible happens to you, there's a risk of like lording it over people. Like, I've seen it all. Like, I've taken away a life, therefore I've seen it all, which is incorrect and a really kind of like a shallow way of looking at it. So it has been interesting to see how that tool has become sharpened, you know, over time, and how empathy is a really interesting process of evolution, and how you can be subtle and nuanced about your empathy as opposed to being like, how are you doing? No, really, tell me honestly, how are you? You know, because like not everyone wants that. And then like identifying people who do want to talk about stuff and keeping other people on a level that's, you know, more surface, or just, you know, like more frivolous, which is also a fine thing. So that's been kind of neat to watch that evolve sort of as I've moved away from the incident and more just into it being a piece of me as opposed to the whole of me, you know?
Right, right. And speaking of being superficial, so my segue was, yeah, this idea of like, I've noticed about myself that I seem to be like tipping into wanting to listen to more sad music.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even realize that was a thing until I suddenly realized I was craving it.
Right.
And I'm wondering how like when, like, do you experience that? Did you go, do you go through pockets where something happens and you sort of need kind of, it just, I'm thinking about it the way that you were talking about, yeah, like your approach to the world. Does it become like,
do you want
to
validate all of the feelings?
Yeah. Do you find yourself to be a person, or were you when you were younger, like even as a teenager before that happened, would you, were you interested in sort of, cause I was just talking to, my last guest who was saying that, you know, she was Kimmy Gatewood. She was saying that she, as a teenager, was really good at sort of putting the blinders on and being like, everything's fine, everything's fine. Keep, and that was like a coping mechanism. Whereas for me, I really wanted to feel the depth of every emotion. I was fascinated by being like,
yeah, you know,
I
avenues.
Did want to listen to music. Like, I feel sad, I want to feel sadder.
Sure.
That's not even a word.
Yeah, let's plumb the depths.
What
were
you like when you were a teen? Did you have that kind of angst, or were you sort of more interested in like...
I always considered, like, I was always very interested in being a deep teen. I wanted to, I had this ritual with my best high school friend, this guy Anthony, and we would go to like a coffee shop and get mochaccinos, bowls of mochaccinos. This was in Quebec in Canada, and like, you know, talk about not like whatever philosophy is when you're 16 years old, you know, try to use like $16,000 words all the time and that sort of thing. And I remember feeling, and you know, so we weren't going out and like getting trashed and partying like, you know, a lot of other people were, and we were feeling really sanctimonious about that. And so I feel like I probably was a fucking insufferable teenager, actually. So I think the stuff when I was a teen, my first CD was Hootie and the Blowfish.
Okay, all right.
Which is horrible. I really liked Ani DeFranco. I really liked Sarah McLachlan. Like, I wanted to listen to very literal feministic, poetic.
Yeah.
Tori Amos was on my playlist a lot. You know, sure. I really wanted to, and maybe it was because I actually, like, I wanted to feel pain, and at that point hadn't felt a lot of it. So I was like, well, this is, so I feel like I had big feelings, but they were always very fleeting because I was a pretty good natured person and I did a lot of sports. And so I had like endorphins coursing through my body all the time. So, but I was like sensitive enough to want to know how the other half lived. I'm doing awkward air quotes. And the other half being like depressed people that I had heard about from these songs that I was listening to. So I feel like it was less like of me wanting to, you know, understand in a holistic fashion all of my feelings. It was like, how maybe I am as angry as Ani DeFranco on this, you know, on what I can't even remember one album name first at this point. But yeah, so I felt like that was not so much a factor. I was putting on a hat definitely when I was listening to like the sad introspective stuff.
Yeah.
It was a costume. It was a mantle.
What sports were you playing besides tennis?
I was playing, I was a sixth man on the basketball team. I played first base on the softball team. I was goalie on the soccer team.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I played a lot. It's because I moved around so much, it was like sport. I was always fine at sports. Like, I had good hand-eye coordination. And so it was always a very, it was my warp zone into sort of having a team.
Absolutely. That
you
makes
know?
So much sense.
Yeah.
You could drop yourself in that way.
Totally.
I really appreciate that somehow you unlocked the secret to that.
I was, I can now, I'm probably doing revisionist history. I'm like, I was so smart, so savvy to know, but it's like, no, I think that when you're a kid, you gravitate towards things you're okay. You know, you want to like be validated for the things that you're okay at. So, but yeah, definitely. It was like, it was a way for me to very quickly become part of teams when,
and how did you, and so did that, was there, is there a social, like that social side of it being with, I'm assuming, more other girls than like
other, yeah. I mean, I didn't kiss a boy till I was 16. I didn't lose my virginity till I was almost 19. Things happened really slowly for me. I was always the girl who was the guy, you know, the guy's friend, but never a girlfriend. Cause I think I was constantly desexualizing myself by like, you know, running laps and turning purple and like wearing jock clothing and not, you know, I didn't really,
did you feel like, did you identify with femininity outside of that, or did you overall just kind of not identify with your own femininity?
Yeah, I don't think I did. I mean, I was like, I was horrified when I got, I think everyone's horrified when they get their period. Everyone, including men. No, I think that, like, especially
might.
Men.
No, they're fine with it.
They're fine with it. I really was staunchly against the girly stuff. I thought that it was a point of weakness. You know, Beyonce wasn't around back then, so I feel like there weren't a lot of great. I mean, I'm sure there were. I just wasn't aware of them. Of like, you know, people who were sort of embracing their femininity in a manner that I could understand and that I wanted to appropriate. So for me, it was just like largely a rejection of that and sort of a desexualizing of myself, because I feel like I didn't even really have desires. There's this great French expression that translates to appetite comes when you're eating. So it's like, just, you know, if you're not hungry, just eat a piece of food and you'll want to eat it. And like, for me, sex was like that. It was like, I was not hungry forever. But then the moment that I kissed a guy, I was like, holy shit. Like, this is all I want to do. This is the best. Like, do everything to my body, you know?
Right.
Within reason, obviously. No butt stuff. But yeah.
And then when that happened, God, I could talk to you forever. I will get into the Smash game shortly, but, when that happened, did it alter? I'm asking you because I relate to our mutual sort of tomboy humor in terms of like not feeling like there's a whole lot that we wouldn't say to each other or around the opposite
Definitely,
sex that
yeah.
maybe isn't sexy. But this idea of like, how you're perceived, like whether or not you altered that at a point once you had that feeling, were you like, oh, do I need to relate to guys differently to get more of this? Or can I just be this person?
No,
and
I think
still get
I identified that actually as like a unique characteristic that I could use in my favor. It was like, oh, just become the person who guys can say anything around and you can say it back. I feel like I noticed, you know, selfishly and manipulatively from an early age, or like not super early, but like somewhere in my mid to late teens, that like I could capitalize on candor and I could trade in candor.
That makes sense.
I feel like I
probably figured that out too.
Yeah. And I don't think
you're like a way of flirting that's like, listen, I flirt differently than these other people.
Yeah.
But that's going to reel in a different kind of fit.
And it's going to be a person where your hooks and grooves line up more, because you're giving more of yourself and you're being more honest. I think the downfall of that is, I feel like for a not a less receptive person, but a more like a somebody who processes things in a more rudimentary way, like a girl talking about sex suddenly just seems like the permission to touch or the permission to be unromantic or something. And that was kind of like a shitty side effect of that. But then you just like learn to avoid those people, you know, who like become like too titillated by the fact that you're speaking candidly. And then you just make sure that it facilitates the cull in a nice way, you know?
That absolutely makes sense.
So you're just like, you're not like ending up in these like wildly inappropriate relationships where like it's all about masks and hiding parts of yourself and stuff like that. And maybe the other thing is like, maybe it burns out quicker as a result, but then if it's meant to burn out quick, great. Like, I feel like that was a good skill that I had, like, because of whenever I learned that skill that we've just been talking about. By the time I got to my 20s, I didn't stay in relationships that were shitty for very long. I was like, okay, this sucks, like, let's move on, you know, next. You know, like the worst thing I think I ever did was I remained in a relationship for 8 months with a man who didn't kiss me on the mouth, which was so weird.
That was like a sporty challenge.
I was like, when am I gonna get it? When am I gonna get his mouth?
What were those conversations like with him?
Oh my God. I remember confronting him about it, and he was like this very he was really funny, and he was really charismatic, and he was really smart and really well read, and I related to all those. They were like, wanted to relate to all those things. And then he would say really opaque stuff like, kissing for me is like the cycles of the moon. And then he'd walk away from me. And I was like, what?
Oh, no.
It was, and you know, I think that when you're in a certain age or when you're in a certain mind frame, you know, and you're interested in mystery, you'll see mystery in shitty behavior, you know, you'll misinterpret somebody being a piece of shit as like a mysterious, interesting, unique human being. And I think that I was just like, I was doing a really nice, you know, job of metabolizing that terrible behavior behavior into something that was interesting, you know, as one does when you're in a newish relationship. You see all the idiosyncrasies as charming, and then most of them after a year are not charming anymore. They're annoying. Or you've chosen the kind of person who like their idiosyncrasies remain.
Or they cycle. Like that, exactly. Depending on whatever's going on with you personally and what's going on in
your relationship. It's like the cycles of the moon.
You know what I find kissing?
It's like,
and maybe you'll follow this, Catherine. Yeah. As like the cycles of the moon. By the way, that certainly makes no sense. Like that doesn't
make sense.
Doesn't even suggest that it might make sense with further exploration.
It would mean that the moon would be not in, like, it would be always in fingernail moon stage. Uh-huh. Like, because it's like a cycle predicates the idea that at one point it will be 180 from what it used to be. So for kissing, for not kissing, it is kissing. So, like, there was no cycle. There was just an absence.
Correct.
So he wasn't that smart. Smart, obviously.
Like, if the asteroid had never hit the Earth, and the Earth had never, and a piece of it hadn't broken off, and it hadn't become the moon, or whatever
is. Is that how the moon was made?
That was just in a Radiolab episode that I highly recommend.
It's a piece of the Earth that broke off?
It's a short. It's either a piece of the Earth, or it's a piece of the asteroid, or something. Oh boy, I can't believe I already
It's a piece.
This.
It's a piece of space junk.
It's definitely a piece of space junk. I think it's that. Because it has to do with how long our days are, and the fact that like there was a time they can tell. It's such a good episode. It's a great little short, guys. If you're interested in getting into Radiolab, this would be a good way in. But it's this. It's about how this asteroid collided with the Earth, and a big piece of it formed eventually into the moon. But that, you know. At first, the way our gravity works, it was like 10 times larger. So like thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, whenever this happened, that if you were just imagine the moon being 10 times closer,
the
like,
moon
what that
was
would be
so
like
dope
that.
Instead and, of looking like yeah, a dumb little sticker in the sky.
Like a little sticker. Exactly. It's about gravity and planetary rotation, and scientists can tell from coral, from studying the growth of coral, the days used to be shorter.
That's fascinating. I feel like I only understood a little bit of it. I do have a suggestion for an alternate podcast. You should do a podcast where you try to reiterate Radiolab episodes.
All right, I'm going to get into
what's
MASH
the game?
With you.
What kind of game are we going to
play? Did you ever play MASH when you were a kid?
No.
It's like M Mansion Apartment Shack House.
Oh, yes, okay, yes. Good. Yeah.
Note to self, I keep forgetting to explain that I'm going to do this before a podcast episode. So many times the listeners had to hear me explain what MASH is.
That's okay.
Over and over.
It's good for first time listeners.
Okay, so let's see here. All right. I like to play sort of a mix of like categories that I'm going to come up with based on the podcast episode that we just had, although some of that was pretty intense.
Okay.
And this is supposed to be a little more whimsical, but, okay, let's say you were, in your 20s, you were a member of a band.
Uh-huh.
You list three, cause we're going to do process of elimination. So one of these three will turn out to be true.
Okay.
You were a member of a band that, this is super imagination time. So this is like, could be that you remember of a band that only exists now, but
okay,
pretending like it was existed back then.
Uh-huh.
But like in your fierce 20s, you were in a band, three that you're like, yeah, I was fucking in that band.
Three bands?
Yeah.
Okay. Bands that I would want to be in. Okay. Pavement.
Great.
Yola Tango.
Awesome. Yeah, they're just about the coolest thing.
Yeah, they're the greatest. And I'm not going to be shy about it. Radiohead.
Fantastic. No reason not to.
They're kind of a little dorky. I feel like, I don't know. Whatever. It appealed to my teen self. When I was trying to be a deep teen.
I brought that up before, too, on the podcast, so I don't want to get too into it, but I'm also fascinated with the Tori Amos stuff. I've said already that she was something that I needed then that I outgrew.
Yes.
And I'm always interested in the idea of, like, an adult person
never outgrowing
art. Both sides, the person who never quote unquote outgrows, not to say I'm superior because
I didn't.
It's just like why you need someone when you need them artistically,
yeah,
and also what it would have felt like to be an adult knowing that what you're making is the most important to a certain age group.
Yeah,
that
I know.
Your age.
Like
group.
Josh Groban really being really important to moms.
Yeah.
And him only ever seeing moms.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just really fascinated
Me
by
too.
That. Okay. Next question is you can
It's a sport that you never did get good at, but suddenly, as of tomorrow, Matrix style, you ace it. You can totally kick ass at it.
Oh, that's a fun question. Skateboarding.
Nice. Two more.
Okay. Oh, two. Sorry. Yeah, right. It's three. Skateboarding, surfing. Mm-hmm. I know that's like the same. And what's another sport that I would like to be good at? Just running, short distance running, like 100 meters. Sprinting. Yeah.
Love it.
Being really fast.
Love it. Love it. Okay. Three foods you can have access to with no ramifications whenever you want.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Eat them all
pizza,
day, every day. Great.
Cake.
What kind of cake do you like?
I like white cake with chocolate icing, but like trashy chocolate icing. I don't want buttercream or anything. Right? I just want like Betty Crocker, you know.
You know what I love is those fucking cookies at the grocery store that are just like
white.
And then they have the sprinkle, the frosting and the sprinkles.
They're like thick, that breaks off.
Yes.
Yes. I love those.
It's like dough.
Yeah.
There's like an element missing. They just decided to cut out all the extra stuff. And
it's like a new matter.
It's sugar. It's flour.
It's salt.
I can't eat
that anymore.
I love that
shit.
Yeah,
that
is trashy delicious. Those cookies are crazy.
They're good. Spaghetti with bolognese sauce.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I'm gonna bring this in. I'm always interested in the answer. Three movies that you can drop into and sort of live inside of for as long or as little as you like.
Oh yeah. I would have liked to drop into. That's a difficult and good question. I don't know if this is true, but it's the first one that came to mind. So I'm going to say that it's true. Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. Just to like hang out with James Earl Jones, I guess, and Ray Liotta and Kevin Costner at that point too. I would like to drop into, this is weird, but I've always wanted to like, I'm too lazy to be a revolutionary. So In the Name of the Father with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Okay. I've never seen that.
It's really good. And these are weird. And then, I don't know if this is correct. And then, I don't know. I just saw the movie Her. Like, I'd be interested in dropping into that for a bit.
Yeah. I haven't seen that yet. It definitely seems like.
You should see it. It's good. If anything, just for like the color palette. I mean, to drop into. It was like a very soothing color palette that movie had.
Yes, indeed. I like the aesthetics of that. Okay. Speaking of color palettes, you are going to create. I'm making this up completely off the top of my head.
That's okay.
There's something that you're going to make that is sort of the now equivalent of, like, I don't know what it is, but it's like people will say about this that it's like
the iPhone or something.
It could be technology.
Yeah.
It could be an invention, or it could be like a masterpiece. Like it could be like you're going to paint something that people say is today's Mona Lisa.
Right.
You're going to create something that people say is like the new iPhone. Or like,
right.
It's this it's unknown thing.
Pre-existing pieces of culture or technology that I can take credit for.
But like what's the thing? We don't even have to know what it is. It doesn't need to be named, but what's the thing that it will be, but like what's the thing it will be compared to?
Right. I understand.
That's a very abstract question.
That's good. I feel like matches.
Uh-huh.
Convenient fire. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like convenient fire.
New matches.
I would love to have written. This is a little dorky, but I think I would have loved to have written a book that's in the style of A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers. You know, like the first like very self-conscious, like sort of semi-autobiographical, but fictional, you know, rides that line.
Yeah.
And then...
Speaking of, I would love, I mean, just from a very, very selfish monetary standpoint for someone to be like, it's the next Harry Potter. Like,
oh God, that would be so, that would be so great. Yeah, I think it was about that with like 50 Shades of Grey, which is a terrible book.
Right.
But it's like to just like crank out a piece of trash like that and then suddenly
that you can't anticipate, but still like
I know,
gets you.
I know. And then the last one would be these are hard questions.
Well, I'm very challenging.
You are very challenging. I would want to I'm going to do something stupid like whatever. You know what it is? It's like some new technology to clean your teeth. Like we just got a Sonicare toothbrush.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it's like the smell that, like, when you first use that toothbrush, the smell that it dislodges from your teeth, it's like when you go to the dentist, it's like smells like burning and fetid food. And it's like, I've had that almost every day, and yes. I've only been using it for a week, and I'm like, holy shit, how much junk is in my mouth? Yeah. So something that's like that, that's like an easy way of, like, that revolutionizes the way that you clean your teeth.
That's great. That's great. These are fantastic answers. Good. No question about it. All right. Fictitious character from anything, movies, literature. I guess it could also be like a celebrity, a person, author, something like that. I'll just widen it way out.
Uh-huh.
That is like, oh, by the way, this person is a really close friend of mine.
Oh, that's neat.
Like, oh, Willy Wonka, for sure. We know each other.
Right. Right. Oh yeah. Willy Wonka was on TV last night. He seems like such a pedophile though. So yeah, it wouldn't be him.
Especially the remake. Especially.
Oh God, that haircut. I mean, they just get like Tim Burton gave Johnny Depp a pedophile's haircut in that.
Yes, he did.
That smooth bowl cut.
Yes, he did.
Okay. I know. The Javier Bardem character from No Country for Old Men. So death incarnate. I want him to be my friend. This is bad to put, because they're a crew, I'm going to name them all as one person.
Okay,
but in
enough.
Real life, like, if I got to walk down the street with all of the members of the Wu-Tang Clan and be nice. Like, they're all my nice. Friends.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be really neat.
Yes. Great answer.
And then I would want, I feel like I want somebody kind of magic, you know, who can, who's a good, help me out with this. Who's like a good magical, and I want it to be a lady, cause I don't have a lady on the list yet.
Magical lady.
Who's a magical lady?
How magical? Like Mary Poppins magical?
Oh my God. Like, Mary Poppins.
Great.
Mary Poppins is great. Cause Mary Poppins, I had this conversation with a friend of mine recently.
She's not that nice.
She's not that nice.
Yeah.
She like is great at etiquette, but not in a way that doesn't allow you to have fun.
Yeah.
She's got like her magic powers is she's got everything in her carpet bag, like everything that you need is in there. And I had this conversation with a friend of mine recently just because it's like, I'm like, you know, I'm sort of in my mid 30s and I feel like I have some existential questions, just, you know, just like common existential questions about like love and relationships and the unending future that is my life and time. Or so it feels like,
sure.
Cause everyone's like, life's so short, but it feels really long right now. I want like a kind of a brassy, interesting lady to be like, hey, you know what? Let me tell you about like, if you're going to make a mistake, here's how to make a mistake.
Or yeah,
here's
she's like queen of tough love.
Yeah.
Like,
don't worry.
Practical, yeah. Hopeful. Tough
well, stop
love.
Bitching and moaning about that thing that you can, you know, like right now, yeah. I'm like, I don't know if I should have a baby. It's like, she'd be like, you're probably just going to have one. So shut up. You know, it's like something like that.
I love how
it doesn't matter if it's
Mary
a 47.
Poppins
you can
is.
Have, yeah. you can have a baby 47. Doesn't
yeah.
matter. You know,
yeah,
don't judge
great.
Yourself for it.
Like, oh God, I really unlocked it with Mary Poppins.
Yeah. It was great.
I've been thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Saving us for Banks, but just because that is perennially this person that you're like, God, what a great example of like feeling like there's a real tenderness there, but there's also like there's no time for nonsense.
No, there's no bullshit with Mary Poppins.
There's also magic. It's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay. Okay, getting closer. Three places that you have a second home, like a vacation home. Like this is where you go.
Can it be silly? Like, oh, outer space
absolutely.
Or okay.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, I want like a place in space somewhere. Great. But you know, luxurious, obviously. Luxurious space place. Space place.
Great.
I would want, I really would like a somewhere in the mountains so I can ski.
Okay. Right, great.
Somewhere neat, like Vail. I don't know. What's the most expensive place you can go skiing? I just want
might
everything.
Be, or like Aspen or
oh,
something.
Oh yeah. Aspen.
Or...
Let's do Aspen. And then I would want Italian villa seems kind of boring. No, you know, Japan. I haven't gone to Japan.
Yeah, I need
so
to
a home. Rad apartment in Tokyo.
There you go. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, I'm saving this for the last. I feel a bit guilty because I'm going to be seeing your boyfriend tonight.
That's okay.
But this is imagination time. Three dudes with whom you share either just like a sexual, one crazy sexual encounter, or can be like your fake imaginary other boyfriend that you get to hang out with, or could be somebody that is from that era of your life where you're in it as a teenager, you like really just wanted to be with, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Whoever all the
time. It's
but
mainly
like
sex based.
Either way.
Okay. I mean, I think like, right now I feel like Matthew McConaughey is like my most like respect, like I have a respect crush on him and I find him very attractive.
Got it.
I mean, Jordan Catalano from My So-Called Life, who is like, you know, one of my first like early wake up experiences to just being like, holy shit. Like, yeah. You know, why don't those men exist in high school right yeah. now? So Jordan Catalano, and I think the masochist in me wants to say Jeff Goldblum, just because I feel like he'd kind of treat you like shit, but he'd be really interesting when he did it.
But he'd be really interesting. He'd be would so interesting.
I don't know.
Are you basing that on things we've heard about him, or is that just characters he's played? Because I feel like he's... I never thought of him... I guess I've never thought of him as better... I've never thought of him as good or bad to a woman.
I thought that... I don't know, the rumor that I've heard, I feel like this is, I mean, this is spurious and it doesn't matter because I'm a nobody, so who knows? I thought he only likes to date people who are already involved in a relationship.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Those are the rumors.
That's
that get
a stupid rumor. I yeah. probably just heard that, like, you know,
I guess
from,
I haven't heard about from him like, as, a, like, you know, in the same way that you hear about, like, somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't heard the rumor.
But that's like, also, that could have come to me in a dream or something. Right. I have no idea if that's true or not, you know?
I mean, I find him very sexy. So
yeah,
I
yeah.
100% am on board for this no matter what.
Kay.
Okay. Very close, very close. It's going to be really interesting to deal with the audio things that have happened in this episode.
Oh, no.
Okay, tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, pausing this for a moment, coming back to reveal your 100% guaranteed future.
Oh.
Okay, feeling pretty good about this. You give a lot of great answers, so
thanks.
Not a lot of misses on this one. First, I'd like to congratulate you for your mansion in space. You did want something luxurious. Not to worry, you did get a mansion.
That's so conspicuous. Conspicuously
yeah,
luxurious.
Really, you know what you got is like Elysium.
Yeah,
you've
I got, did. That's
basically
great.
Basically got
that's
Elysium
great.
All to yourself. I guess you could share it with the people who didn't have the good fortune of experiencing it until the end of Elysium.
No, I want to just have it on my own. I just want to walk around Elysium
space
by
hog.
Myself like a wild
You're
woman.
A space hog.
Yeah.
Mansion in space. okay. I want to... Interesting. I'm wondering, too, if like you've got this sort of like... thing that happens in sci-fi movies where you're trying to preserve pieces of the earth in case it explodes.
Right.
Because I like the idea of you surfing in space. Like somehow you have this sort of...
Well, there's a Silver Surfer character,
ocean.
Right? Like there's...
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
There's tons of stuff to surf in space.
So there's some space surfing because you've certainly perfected that skill.
You get to like surf in and you get to surf inside a wormhole probably and go somewhere else.
Ooh.
Like you... Like a space... Dude, space is the biggest wave out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you really couldn't
Don't
have
you
come
think?
Up with a better... place. Space is the biggest wave out there.
Yeah.
I'm going to punch you in the face with joy. Not to worry. In space, you have access to plenty of pizza.
Great.
So
oh, that's good. I'm so glad it was pizza.
Yourself.
Cause I felt I didn't like my spaghetti bolognese. I love spaghetti yeah. bolognese, but like, yeah, pizza's
it's really
great.
Tough to beat pizza.
Yeah.
Plenty of pizza to go around for your best friends, the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yay.
Plenty
I'm
of
sure they
for them in your space mansion.
They'd love that too. Cause they always have the munchies. That's great. You only want to eat pizza when you have
so
the
great.
Munchies.
This is something as well when you're ready to really ground yourself
uh-huh.
yet you're also in a fake place
right.
drop right on into Field of Dreams.
Great. That's not
it's a nice it feels like a nice balance.
I like that because then I when I drop into Earth I am dropping like transgenerationally, like, you know, I am dropping
oh, yeah.
into magic Earth. I'm
yeah.
not just dropping into normal boring old space-time continuum Earth
yeah.
like there
magic
is
baseball Earth.
Magic baseball Earth.
Magic baseball till the land.
This is great.
Earth. You've also invented, and perhaps this is the reason you have such a resplendent space place, the new matches.
New matches.
Instant fire.
I'm Prometheus.
You're Prometheus. That's pretty amazing. And you also, and this is cool too, because not only do you have your old friends, the Wu-Tang, your new friends, the Wu-Tang Clan that you can hang out with all the time, but as a member of Yola Tango... You also, I'm sure, have access to like all your bandmates, your former bandmates. Maybe you reunite with them and play sometime.
I'm the female drummer of Georgia Hubley, the female drummer of Yola Tango, who happens to be married to the lead singer, Ira Kaplan of Yola Tango. So
yeah.
if I'm in the band, then I'm with my husband, which is great.
You are. I don't know where Matthew McConaughey fits into this.
Oh, I'm so glad
but
it
you
was
also
him.
Got him.
This is so great.
So that's the. Those are the results of your MASH game.
Do you know what just happened?
MASH.
You just created a reality that I mean is obviously like based on great questions from you fine answers from me, but mashed together like that, I will kill myself before the end of the day, because the fact I will not get to live in the reality that you just outlined.
I'm really sorry.
Sending me to like paroxysms of sadness.
That's the purpose of MASH.
That's a dangerous game.
Yeah.
That's a game that's smart that kids play that game before they're familiar with the concept of suicide. Oh, because I think that if we played that more as adults, we would be way, I mean, it's like most adults are quite sad. I think we'd be even sadder.
Yeah. I think I enjoy the sort of richness of the return to that sort of fantasy without feeling like I'm too miserable where I am. But it's tricky, I know.
I have an idea for you. Okay, forget the radio, the you reiterating Radiolab episodes. Yeah. I think what you should do is start a cult or like a Tony Robbins style like self-improvement seminar that has to do with you playing the MASH game with your followers and then having that be an aspirational map for them, and they have to enact what they have said with your help from the MASH game in their actual lives here on Earth.
So how does that, so are you saying that it would be like you could be as fantastical as we just were, and then you have to find a practical application, like what is the real version of that,
or like take the things that are fantastical and the ones that you can actually reach. Like, I mean, if I'd worked hard enough, I could probably insinuate myself into the Wu-Tang Clan.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I just like got the right connections and was cool enough and whatever, I feel like I could be of use in that gang, you know? And then obviously like I won't live in space, but I could like travel there, because you can do that now. Yeah, and
I'm fascinated by the idea of the sort of big, like high hopes, kind of secret, anything's possible side of the really fantastical part of that. But I'm equally as interested in the idea of the psychoanalysis of what do the Wu-Tang Clan represent to you? Why were you interested in them? And how do you apply? Like, what is it? Like, let's find out the qualities about them that you can then incorporate more into your life without it being them in the concrete world.
Right. Like, is it because they are a crew that are all friends? Is it because they're very talented and they've made a lot of money off something that seems really authentic?
Is space because you feel like you're not getting enough time to yourself? You know what I'm saying?
This
like,
is very
you could
smart.
Really go down that road.
Do it. You figured out a way better version of the version that I was talking about. So we'll workshop
this together. Yeah.
You can be the CEO, but I want to have, I want to be like your David Miscavige, is it David Miscavige, the Scientology guy? I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Oh, I don't know.
But he's like the pit bull of the science, you know, he's like the jerk. I want to be like your jerk in this scheme,
is gonna be great.
But I want you to be the charismatic, like you're the face.
Okay.
But I'm the enforcer.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a thing. It's like when people really difficult people have like bulldogish agents so that they can just seem super easy.
Exactly.
Like, I'm sorry, my agent.
You're the talent. I'm the agent. That's what I.
This is very exciting indeed.
We're gonna make some money.
Yeah, this is very exciting. I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah.
I think maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do some sort of exercise with you guys, the listener, because it's been a while since I've gotten you guys more involved. It'd be really fun if we did an episode where I had you back and I send out a list, like on the Facebook page. I put a list of categories of things. We'll pick like 10 that people send back in,
and we'll figure out how to make their lives better.
And we'll you and I'll sit and hash it out and be like, okay, da da da. Like we'll sort of, and then we'll, I don't know.
I'm in.
Like an ongoing thing.
That sounds great.
It's very exciting.
Yeah,
this was such a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me. Remember when I was so insecure at the beginning and you had to tell me. So foolish.
You're a fool.
Thanks for having me,
guys. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time on the podcast. As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.